Now, we have quite a bit of material to cover today. It is a bit more harder, perhaps, to get a good understanding of than what we had yesterday, because we're dealing with one man yesterday and with his varied experiences, contacts, and influence. Today, I want to cover a number of important elements of the history of Christianity in the third century. I want to finish up the third century today. And I'm going, first of all, today to deal with three great enemies of Christianity during this third century. I'm going to put them under two heads. I haven't yet given you the head. But I want to stress that these three great enemies of Christianity in the third century that I will mention under two heads were great forces in the third century which, to an outsider, might have seemed to be the wave of the future rather than Christianity. We notice that during the second century, the great enemy of Christianity, aside, of course, from the great pagan influences, was Gnosticism, and the many different types of Gnosticism, but we notice what they had in common, the certain elements that were common to many of them, though there's probably no one element that was common to every Gnostic sect, but there were a number which were common to perhaps three-fourths of them, but a different three-fourths with each one. There was a tremendous variety of viewpoints, and an outsider would have really wondered what was Orthodox Christianity, which were these various Gnostic sects. But most of them, by the third century, had about run their course and were beginning to disappear. But Christianity faced three great new enemies then. This was partly due to the fact that, as we noticed, even as early as the time of Christ, the pagan world was, to quite an extent, at least its educated portion, losing faith in the old polytheistic worship and the old God. They were established in the forms of their religious life and many aspects of their political life, but Cicero, for instance, 50 years before the death of Christ, Cicero, who was so anxious to become a great leader in Rome, was proud to take a high position in the cult of the pagan gods, even though in his writings he makes it clear he had no faith in them, whatever. But he advanced in politics, and he was glad to take this position to interpret the auguries, the signs which were supposed to tell what the future was according to the pagan gods. The educated portion of the Roman world, the Greek world, to a large extent, was losing faith in the old myth. And there was a longing for something better, a longing for something that would give real meaning to life. And there were three movements which, during this century, spread so widely that it might have been thought that one of them was the wave of the future rather than Christianity. I'm going to look at two of these under one head. We'll call that G under four. G I will call Mithraism and Manichaeism. Mithraism spelled M-I-T-H-R-A-ism. Mithraism. And Manichaeism, M-A-N-I-C-H-A-E-I-S-M. Manichaeism. You'll often hear it called this, but the newer style seems to be to call it Manichaeism, which is probably more logical than calling it Manichaeism, because Manichaeum is the adjective from it. Mithraism and Manichaeism. Under that number one, then, Mithraism. Mithraism spread through the Roman Empire during this third century. It is a religion which came from Persia. It is based upon Zoroastrianism, though it is a development of certain features of Zoroastrianism, particularly of the feature of a deity who is prominent in the Persian religion of Zoroastrianism, a deity Mithra, M-I-T-H-R-A-S. And this, we find traces of this entering the Roman Empire as early as the time of Christ. But during the third century, it spread widely through the empire, and temples to Mithras have been found in Britain, in France, in different parts of Italy, in Greece, in many parts of the empire. Now, not, of course, at all comparable to the number of Christian churches you'd find in these areas today or during the Middle Ages. But yet, enough of them to show that it was a growing movement. It was a movement which seems particularly to have been strong among the soldiers. It was looked upon as the soldiers' religion by men. And here is a point of weakness in the religion, that it seemed to have little place for women in it at all. It was very definitely a man's religion. Now, I read in the paper just last week of the discovery of a new Mithras temple that had the remains of Mithras temple previously unknown in a section which was not a particularly military section. Someone was suggesting we must revise our idea that it was to the large extent a military religion. I doubt if the new evidence is sufficient to revise what we have so much evidence for, that where the Roman legions went, especially on the borders of the empire, there were many who were worshiping this Mithras cult. Now, the Mithras religion had taken over certain features from the mystery religions which had come from Egypt and from other lands into different parts of the Roman Empire in the previous couple of centuries. And many of these elements are very similar to elements in Christianity. For instance, there is in some of these mystery religions and taken over into the mystery cult, there is a meal somewhat like the Christian Last Supper, in which the people participate and they consider they're having communion with the god Mithras. And there it was something similar to baptism. Now, the details of it, we have no Mithraic literature that has been preserved, so that what we know about it is largely from the criticism of it by Christians. But we know that in one of these mystery religions, and perhaps in the Mithra religion, there was a sort of a baptism which was performed by having a man stand in a place that was cut out in the ground. And he stood there, and there was a little lattice work above it, where the strong lattice work, but with many holes, and on top of that, they killed a bull, so that the blood of the bull sprinkled down upon the person who was underneath. And this was supposed to give him a union with the god, the new life being represented by the destruction of the bull and the sprinkling of the blood of the bull upon the person below. Well, there are enough similarities to Christian practices in the Mithras religion and some of these mystery religions that there have been those who have tried to say that Christianity had taken many of its teachings and many of its ceremonies from these mystery religions. But the Dr. J. Gresham Mason wrote a book on the origin of Paul's religion, in which he went into it very thoroughly, examined the details very thoroughly, and endeavored to show that all the evidence we have for such practices in these religions come from a much later time than the evidence we have for these practices in Christianity. And therefore, the influence would seem to be the other way around. Basically and fundamentally, they were very different from Christianity. But they took over various forms and ceremonies and various ideas, and in particular, they stressed the idea of identification with the god, of union with the god, this personal aspect which was to a great extent lacking in the old pagan religion, but which is so vital a part of Christianity, was imitated in these mystery religions, and particularly in Mithraism. Well, by the at the end of the 3rd century, there were those who thought that Mithraism would eventually displace the pagan religion of Rome. But it didn't last much beyond the end of the century we're now looking at. It is definitely a heathen religion, not a sect of Christianity in any sense. And therefore, some churches we do not mention at all. But it certainly should be mentioned because it was a very powerful force that Christianity had to meet during that century. Now, number two, Manichaeism. Manichaeism is somewhat different in that there were those who easily confused it with Christianity. In fact, Manichaeism is often spoken of as an outgrowth of Gnosticism. That is a bit oversimplified. But it certainly has many similarities to Gnosticism, and so some It is mentioned in all church histories, and some will even say that it is a form of Gnosticism which survived after the other forms disappeared. And Manichaeism was continued to exist to some extent for many, many centuries. It traces its origin, however, to a definite human being, different from Mithraism, which traces it back to a Persian myth. It traces it to a definite human being named Mani, M-A-N-I, after whom it is named. And Mani was born in Persia at about 215 A.D. He lived in Persia there, and he seems to have constructed his religion by combining certain elements of Zoroastrianism and certain elements of Christianity. He was a man of means. He traveled extensively. He studied many things. He wrote and lectured a great deal. He came to the West, eventually went back to the East, and eventually was killed by the king of Persia. He had quite an influence in the Persian court, many followers, but then a king came in there who was opposed to him, and he killed him, but his followers were already rather widely extended in the Persian Empire and also in the Roman Empire. And even 1,000 years later, saying a person had fallen into great heresy, it was common to speak of him as being guilty of Manichaeism. The term thus continued much later than Mithraism, for instance, and many of the beliefs. Now, this Manichaean belief, I might mention first that they organized their church with 12 so-called apostles at the head of it, and with bishops, and with an organization which gave considerable strength to their propaganda and to their establishing centers here and there. It became very powerful in North Africa. In the century after this, at the beginning of the 5th century, St. Augustine, before he became a Christian, for 9 years attended Manichaean services and was greatly attracted by Manichaeism for a time. It spread through many different areas and had a very wide influence. Now, it is a religion which has this in common with Gnosticism, that it thinks of evil as a great force and good striving against the evil. Manichaeism sees good and evil struggling against each other, and conflict rather even. It does not believe in a sovereign God at all, but in two great principles fighting one another. In opposition to Gnosticism, it does not believe that it was an evil God who created the world. It believes that the good God created the world, but that the evil God created man. And so, according to Manichaeism, there's the world of light and the world of darkness, the world of good, the world of evil, and the world of evil created man, but the world of good tried to change man and to make him worthwhile. And thus, the good does not, like Gnosticism, glorify the evil characters of the Old Testament and run down the good characters. It takes the side of the good characters, but it considers man as originally evil and as properly belonging to Satan, but as God trying to win him away from Satan. And it believes that Jesus was a representative of the world of light coming into this world of darkness, but this was not the historical figure of Jesus. This is a spirit which never was born and never died. The historical Jesus is only a mere man, according to the Manichaean. So you see what a hodgepodge of ideas it is, and yet this strong idea of good and evil fighting against each other and rather equally matched is something that we find today in certain circles. It is very different from the Christian view of the sovereign God who has established all things and who permits evil for his own purposes. Well, Manichaeism and Mithraism are two of these great enemies of Christianity during the 3rd century. I mentioned Manichaeism second as the later of them to be started and also the one which lasted by far the longest.
We will move on to chapter 8, which is the third of these great enemies during that century, and that is one which continues to some extent to the present day. It is called Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism. NEO-PLATONISM. Neoplatonism. And Neoplatonism, while it was becoming a great enemy of Christianity during the third century, continued during the succeeding centuries to be a great force against Christianity. We will want to go into it, therefore, somewhat more in detail than we have these two. Neoplatonism is, under this number one, its background and nature. Neoplatonism represents a direct development from the philosophers of Greece. It is a development which tries to explain the universe in terms of certain philosophic concepts, but it is not based upon science or upon observed facts, but entirely upon certain theoretical ideas. But these ideas were put together very skillfully and made a great appeal to those who were dissatisfied with the difficulties and complexities of the world as it is. Someone has said that never was there a movement which more greatly emphasized the dignity of man and the great potentialities of man than Neoplatonism, but never was there one which was more derogatory to the idea of science or of a careful examination and solid experimental thinking than Neoplatonism. Now, there are traces of it as early as Philo, the Jewish thinker of shortly after the time of Christ. And we find Philo, to some extent, in dealing with the Old Testament, doing what a number of the Greek philosophers had done with the heathen myths, demythologizing. That is, trying to take these myths or these stories as something which didn't actually happen at all, but yet which has a great content, a great spiritual meaning for us, even though it itself does not actually represent something that really happened. And so they would accept all of these pagan ideas about the great pagan gods and the stories, the myths and legends, but they would interpret them as being simply a presentation of spiritual truth, of metaphysical truth, rather than as anything which had actually occurred. Neoplatonism comes particularly to the fore through three great leaders, the second of whom is the outstanding one. I will mention them briefly as numbers 2, 3, and 4 under this text. Number 2 is Ammoniacus Sacca. Ammoniacus, A-M-M-O-N-I-A-C-U-S. Ammoniacus Sacca, capital S-A-C-C-U-S. He would seem to have been a man who came from perhaps from Athens, but who went to Alexandria. I mentioned him to you last week, mentioning that Origen attended some of his classes, wishing to learn at first hand of the various anti-Christian ideas of the day. Ammonius, or Ammoniacus, both things are used for him, Sacchus, had a school in Alexandria with a number of students who were greatly interested in learning his theosophic concepts about the interpretation of the universe and his explaining of the pagan myth as conveying a great truth for our lives to us. We have nothing left that he wrote, but he had a very considerable influence on a group of enthusiastic students who followed him. The outstanding one of these, we mention as number 3, Plotinus. Plotinus. P-L-O-T-I-N-U-S. Plotinus. Now, Plotinus was born in 204 and died in 269. It would seem likely that he was an Egyptian, but we know very little about his life. This book, published recently by the University of Chicago, the Plotinus in the Great Books of the Western World, in its biographical note, begins with the word, "Plotinus, according to his biographer and disciple Porphyry, quote, seemed to be ashamed of being in a body, and hence refused to tell anything about his parents, his ancestry, or his country. He is known, however, to have come from Egypt, and there are certain theories as to where he was born in Egypt. But he studied with Ammonius Saccas in Egypt, was a brilliant follower of Saccas, and then was anxious to study the philosophies of Persia and India, and went with the Roman army in that direction on an expedition, but the army met with defeat and came back, so he did not reach his goal. But he came back with the army and went to Rome at the age of 40 and began his school in Rome. And for 25 years he taught in Rome. And during this time, there were one or two emperors whose members of his family attended his school and were greatly devoted to him. He must have been a very inspiring teacher, one who could present grave metaphysical theories with no factual basis whatever, but in such an impressive manner that people felt that here was indeed the answer to all of the problems of the universe. After Plotinus' death, his notes were gathered together by his followers and put into six groups of nine sections. And the Greek word for nine, make an enya, a group of nine sections. And so there's six of these. 54 sections in six divisions, six enyas by Plotinus. The University of Chicago Press has published what they call the Great Books of the Western World. And in this series, what they call the Great Books of the Western World, they have nothing by Calvin, nothing by Luther, but they have a whole volume by Plotinus, which they include as one of the great books of the Western world. Well, it has had a great influence in certain circles. I don't know if you can say it's had an influence among great numbers of people, but it has influenced a few people in many different areas. And thus it had a very wide influence in Kenya. They were translated into Arabic. They were read among the Mohammedans. They later came around to North Africa and Spain and came back into Europe that way. Plotinus is referred to by some of these medieval Arabic writers as the philosopher. And you find maybe if you spend hours working into it, you could become enthralled with it as Plotinus, it seems, work. If you just dip into it, it seems like a lot of very thin and theorizing. But his interpretation of the universe explained it on the basis of these principles of the essence of the soul, the great first principles, the good, all sorts of things that are largely, at least they're not solid. They're not, they can't be touched or handled or experimented with, or most of them even proven to exist. But his attitude toward the Greek God and the Roman gods of not denying any of them, not opposing any of them, but surely it's all true, we accept it all. But then we explain it away, like the modernists do much of our Christian teaching of the Bible. Now the Neoplatonists found that Christianity took an exclusive attitude. It insisted the Bible was true and refused to accept the idea that the great truth was found in all these other places too. And so it became perhaps one of the very strongest enemies of Christianity. It was never an organized movement like Manichaeism. It was rather a philosophy that spread among various thinkers, and that the recent encyclopedia articles claim it had great effect upon Christianity itself, even in modern times. In the next century, in the fourth century, we find the attempt made to substitute Neoplatonism for Christianity. And some of the greatest persecutors of Christianity were devoted to the Neoplatonist teaching. So Plotinus is a great Neoplatonist writer. Number four, Porphyry. P-O-R-P-H-Y-R-Y. Porphyry. Lived from 232 to 304. As you see, about 30 years younger than Plotinus. He was Plotinus' great disciple, greatly attached to Plotinus. He had much to do with putting the Annals into their final form after Plotinus' death. Yes? 232 to 304, Porphyry. But Porphyry felt that the great enemy of Neoplatonism was Christianity. And so Porphyry devoted himself largely to writing against Christianity, trying to show that the Christian interpretation of the Bible was completely wrong and that the Bible was not true. He wrote extensively, for instance, on the book of Daniel, trying to show that instead of Daniel predicting correctly Antiochus Epiphanes and the troubles of the Maccabean time, it must have been written after that time. And that, of course, is what the modernists hold today, is the ideas which were advanced by Porphyry. Yes? Yes, the Plotinus sought union with the great divine original spirit, and he claimed that four times in his life he attained it. I don't know how long, that's a very deep period. And that was his object, was to get out of the body, to get away from everything, to get into union with the great divine spirit. Yes? I hardly think you could attribute that to Neoplatonism, because you find that in common with so many other things. Manichaeism had much to do. I don't think that you can attribute that to Neoplatonism. In fact, I would say that where Neoplatonism is claimed to have influenced Christianity, they have either influenced it by giving it something to fight against, and therefore bringing out clearly what Christianity actually held. But I don't believe it's true Christianity. True Christianity is built on the Bible. And anything that comes sharply against it will sharpen our understanding of it and make us examine it more clearly. And of course, it may affect our phraseology, our expression. But the modernistic attitude that explains all Christian views as a process of developing Neoplatonism, they think, is one large element to enter in. I don't believe that. It proves true on careful examination. But these three great enemies we must have in mind. We will have many references to Manichaeism, none of them very long, but many of them in the course of the next 5 months. Neoplatonism, we will find, a very active force in the following century, and we won't have, then of course it becomes a minor force in the Dark Ages, but comes back again to some extent in modern times. Yes? No, I say the true Christians accept the Bible as a complete source of truth. The Neoplatonists would accept the pagan myth as truth. And they might accept some parts of the Bible similarly as being a source of spiritual value, if that would be all. They would not accept Christian teaching. They would not attribute any special authority to the Bible. Oh, yes, yes. But Porphyry went into historical evidences to try to disprove Christianity right straight down the line. And he was a very active anti-Christian writer, like Celsus, as you noticed in the previous century. And Origen wrote extensively anti-Celsus. In the next century, Jerome wrote extensively anti-Porphyry, as we come to Jerome later. Now, capital J I hate to rush through 40 years in a few minutes, but we do not have many striking events in the next period of the last 40 years of this century. But I want you to realize it's a very considerable length of time. 40 years of freedom from persecution. You remember Jesus in 2:50 tried to destroy Christianity by destroying the leaders. Had his great persecution, then he died in battle, and the persecution stopped for about 5 or 6 years, and then Valerian began again and intentionally attempted to destroy Christianity for 2 or 3 years. During that persecution, that Cyprian was killed. Well, his son Gallienus, who succeeded him a year or two after that, made a proclamation giving Christianity a position as a permitted religion in the Roman Empire, an edict of toleration, we noticed at the beginning of our consideration of this century. And so from about 262 until about 304, we have a period of 40 years in which there is practically no persecution. Gallienus has recognized Christianity as a permitted religion within the empire. Why do we have so comparatively little of real interest to us during this period of 40 years? People who were only 25 when the Edict of Toleration came out were 65 before this period of toleration came to an end. Why do we have so little of real interest? I think perhaps one reason would be because so many of the leaders of the church had been killed in the two great persecutions between 250 and 260. That persecution, they deliberately shot off the bishops and the presbyters. And many of them were martyred, and many of them were sent to work in the mines where they wouldn't live very long. And while there were not great numbers of Christians killed in those persecutions, they probably affected the church more seriously than any before because of the great number of martyrs that were killed in them. But after these persecutions were over, the great mass of the people had seen how bravely the Christian leaders had gone to their death. While they had seen many Christians who turned back on their faith and sacrificed, they had seen many who lapsed. They saw a far greater number, some of them who had been very weak Christians before, who boldly faced the persecution, the torture, and the death. And once the persecution was ended and there was complete toleration, great numbers of people came into the Christian church. And so through these 40 years were a period of great growth. We'll make that number one under these 40 years. A period of great growth of the church. It was still a comparatively small movement compared with the total population. But there were great numbers of people who came into the church during these 40 years. And the way the Christians had endured and faced the persecution immediately before had a good bit to do with that. We have very no evidence of any outstanding great Christian leaders during these 40 years. No one to compare with Cyprian or Hippolytus or Tertullian or Irenaeus. No one like that. But there doubtless were many earnest, hard-working men who worked in the churches all over the empire, fought against Mithraism, Manichaeism, and Neoplatonism, made no compromise with those beliefs, but tried to win people to Christ and to develop the churches. And under the new edict, they were permitted to build their churches. They were given protection by the state against interference with their churches. And you have a great increase in the size of the Christian group. You have many becoming very real Christians, but you doubtless had a great increase in worldliness. I'm going to make that number two, worldliness. There were many who found it advantageous to come into the Christian church. And I think one of the clearest evidences of worldliness is the life of Paul of Samosata. And so I'm going to make him number three. Paul of Samosata, capital S-A-M-O-S-A-T-A. Paul of Samosata became the bishop of Antioch. And he had a great church in Antioch, in Syria, the second largest city in the Roman Empire. And Paul of Samosata was found to be, in his attempt to explain the Trinity, he was found to be denying the deity of Christ, saying that God the Father had simply entered into the man Christ. said not that Christ was God. And he was not so very clear in his expression. He was not really a theologian, but his views were sufficiently contrary to Christian truth that there were two or three councils, there were three councils held of bishops in the area, which condemned him for his erroneous views. And we have the records of these councils, and we find that what they said about Paul went into other things as well. They said that his style of preaching was very theatrical, that he sought particularly popularity with the Pharisees, that he had groups of men whom he hired to sit in the church and to clap at appropriate occasions, and to start applause for them. He prided himself on a secular office which he held in the city of Antioch. And he thus would seem to have been a very, from what his enemy said, a very worldly prelate, typical of the harmful side of the development of the church at this time. We must remember, of course, this is from his enemy. And perhaps he was not as bad as they thought. They condemned him as a heretic and said he should not be bishop of Antioch, but in the political situation of the day, when a queen, Zenobia, who was a friend of his, reigned through this area, he disregarded the decision of the bishops and continued to hold the greatest church in Antioch and to act as bishop for another several years. But then this king was overcome by the Roman Emperor Aurelian, who was a strong pagan, and this pagan emperor investigated the matter and decided that the bishop's authority should be followed in the Christian church and dispossess Paul of Samosata of his church. And his teaching, we find some effects of in the next century. But we go on to number four, Lucian. L-U-C-I-A-N. Now the name Lucian was the name of a pagan satirist a century before this, who was quite an enemy of Christianity. We did not discuss him, but you will occasionally find references to him. So I mention that he is not the Lucian we are dealing with here. He was in the second century. This was the head of the church in Antioch, a man named Lucian, who was supported by Paul of Samosata and who had a great number of students who were very much devoted to him. And this Lucian was also a great textual student. And he studied the text of the New Testament and of the Old, comparing manuscripts to try to get the correct text of the Old and New Testament. And many today feel that Lucian did not have a proper understanding of textual criticism, and therefore that harm was done rather than good by his attempt to fix a correct text. And therefore they like to get texts from earlier than Lucian's time. But he was a man who was greatly interested in this and had a great reputation as a scholar. He tried to explain the Trinity and fell into some of the errors of Monarchian. As you remember, Monarchianism is a very important tendency within the church, within the Christian church at this time, as people try to explain what we cannot explain. The fact that Jesus is fully God and yet is fully man, and that there is only one God, and yet God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, coming taken from all eternity, but one God. Trying to explain it, they go too far one way or the other. And Lucian was attributed with the influence which produced some of the ideas with which in the next century he will have much to do. At this point, I merely place him in his proper setting. We'll refer to that later on. And as our last heading under this third century, I want to take K, the Church of Rome in the third century. The Church of Rome in the third century. Rome was the greatest city in the empire. It was the largest city, the most prosperous. All great thinkers, great leaders of every kind naturally gravitated to Rome during this century. And the Christian church in Rome was a church of considerable size, a church which had many important martyrs, a church which had considerable influence. Under these circumstances, we would expect that the leader of the church of Rome would be a man who, by his personal ability, by his personality, by his clear thinking, by his leadership, would win high recognition throughout the Christian world. It would be very, very strange if, under these circumstances, the Bishop of Rome did not gain such leadership and such influence throughout the Christian world. So it is a very, very strange thing that if you name the men in Christian history between the death of Christ, or between, let us say, omitting anything in the Bible, men from the end of what is contained in the Bible up to 440 A.D., if you would mention the 30 men who are most influential by their writings, by their personality, by their influence, by their clear thinking, by their understanding of Christian truth, by all the natural abilities or results of hard work and study that go to make a man a great leader, if he would learn name the 30 greatest in the period between the end of the Bible and 440 A.D., not a single one would be a bishop of Rome. Now, when I say not a single one, there is possible one exception. Clement wrote his first epistle to the Corinthians in about 90 A.D., and we know practically nothing about Clement except for that. Now, if somebody wants to think that that epistle is good enough and important enough to put him among the first 30, why, that would be one exception. But that certainly could be argued. He certainly would not be among the first 15 or 20. But that is a very strange thing. It's not what you would expect at all. You would naturally expect the leader of the church in the greatest city of the empire, the capital of the empire, the place where the thinkers and the people of influence naturally congregate, would be among the greatest leaders. But it was not so for 400 years after the death of Christ. And on any arrangement of chance operation, you would expect that at least two or three of the leading 30 leaders of the Christian church during this period would have been bishops of Rome. I cannot account for their complete lack during this long period on any other ground than that God in his providence caused it to be exactly that way, because he knew that in later centuries bishops of Rome would claim that to them had been committed by God the supreme authority and control of the Christian church. It is a strange, and it would be strange indeed if God had so committed it, that neither Cyprian, Irenaeus, Tertullian, Hippolytus, Origen, any of the great thinkers, great leaders of the Christian church during this period of 400 years would have been bishops of Rome. It's not till 440 A.D. that we find a bishop of Rome who deserves rank as one of the great Christian leaders of the ancient world. Pope Leo I, called Leo the Great, was a great man and a great leader and a man who left a great influence on the whole Christian church. But it was not until 400 years after the death of Christ that such a man came to leadership in the Church of Rome. Well, now we have noticed how mysterious is Roman Catholic church history. By centuries, we have noticed how McSorley said that in the first century, some of the popes are very shadowy characters of whom nothing is known but their names, and some of them we're not even sure of whether it's one man or two. Well, that is not strange in the first century, because we know very little about any Christians aside from what the New Testament says during the first century. So that doesn't mean much. But during the second century, we have some great Christian leaders, but none of them are bishops of Rome. We notice three men of whom who are of any importance here who were bishops of Rome, and they were not of any really great influence. But then we come to the third century, and in the third century we find that there were 15 men who occupied the position of bishop of Rome, and a number of them were martyrs who doubtless bravely suffered for their faith. The first two of them in this century were Zephyrinus and Callistus. We know what Hippolytus said of that. Hippolytus, who was revered as a great saint during the whole Middle Ages. And he considered them both as being very inferior individuals and not worthy of any Christian leadership. Then we have nobody of any outstanding importance as a bishop of Rome until we get to Cornelius, who was only bishop 2 years, from 251 to 253. His principal importance is that it was in opposition to his election that Novatian led out his group, that began the Novatian Church, that continued as a separate denomination for several centuries. And there is no criticism that I've ever heard made against Novatian's orthodoxy or against his true Christianity. Some say he was too strict and too stern in his moral sense. That's the only thing I've ever heard of him except against him, except that he did not bow to the authority of the one who was elected as bishop. Then we have Stephen, who was bishop from 254 to 257. McSorley says, Saint Stephen first is known mainly for his defense of the validity of heretical baptism against St. Cyprian, who had ruled that persons baptized by heretics should be rebaptized before reception into the church. Well, Cyprian towers over Stephen in every conceivable way. We get to St. Eutychian, as he calls him, 275 to 283. McSorley says practically nothing is known of his pontificate. We get St. Caius, 283 to 296, 13 years. Nothing is known of his pontificate. Then we get St. Marcellinus, 296 to 304. McSorley says, began to rule just before the outbreak of the persecution under Diocletian. 100 years after his death, Adonisus, bishop in Africa, affirmed that Marcellinus had denied the faith. But the truth of this report was questioned by St. Augustine. There remains, however, a probability that during the persecution, he did not behave with sufficient bravery to win the respect of the faithful. So as you see, the bishops of Rome during this period are men of comparatively little standing or ability, as was the case during the previous century. And when we get to 440, we get a man of really great ability in the position of bishop of Rome. And it was his great ability that elevated your respect for that position to a very great extent. But we have a great deal to cover before we get to Leo the Great. Now, I rushed a little fast over some of these to be sure to get through that. I didn't need to go quite as fast because we have another 3 minutes left. But I think a good place to make a break is the end of the sentence. But let's take just a minute and see if there's anything that isn't quite clear that anyone would like to ask any questions about. Yes, Mr. West. Anyway,
I think it's more
E-N-N-E-A-D. E-N-N-E-A-D. Enyad. And Enyad means something of nine, a ninefold group. So there are nine Enyad, there are nine sections in one Enyad, one group of nine, and there's six Enyad. And as I said, the University of Chicago thinks they're important enough to be one of the great books of the Western world, so Calvin, Luther, or not. Yes? Yes. Basically, the Neoplatonists believe in a world of ideas as distinct from matter and physical things. That the matter and physical things did not matter. That it was the ideas, the world of ideas that mattered, and about the only way they could learn about these ideas seems to be through their imagination and through their putting things together and making theory. But they tried to get away from the world of matter and to get into union with the great spirit that tackled it all. It's a theoretical, purely imaginary approach, but it's a... Yes, Mr. Hill? Lucian was the head of the school in Antioch. Paul of Samosata was the bishop of Antioch. Lucian became head of the school toward the end of Paul's time as bishop and continued. He was a martyr. I should have mentioned Lucian continued as head of the school until the great Diocletian persecution. And he was a martyr, so he was revered as a martyr, even though some thought some of his ideas were heretical. Yes? Yes. Yes. The first of these, as far as I know, the first of which we have record is the catechetical school in Alexandria, of which Clement of Alexandria was the head. And then you remember when Origen was driven out of Alexandria, he formed a school in Antioch.